Rarely a shift goes by that I don't care for an employee with a body fluid exposure, and I'll have to say it can sometimes be a strange interaction because there's never an absolute right answer. Sure, I can give a recommendation, but after being presented the data, much of the decision-making onus is put on the patient. Sometimes I feel I don't really know what I'm talking about. So let's get educated about needle sticks and body fluid exposure. And we're here with Greg Moran, emergency medicine infectious disease expert, to walk through the steps, the ins, the outs, the quagmires, and misconceptions about body fluid exposure.
It's Greg Moran.
Greg Moran, the body fluid and infectious disease expert.
Body fluid exposures, if done in the privacy of your own home with your loved ones, is all your business. But in the workplace, we like to keep it professional. Keep the body fluids to themselves.
Oh, behave.
I have found that this is something that should be such a quick in and out. And it feels like reinventing the wheel whenever somebody comes into the ED with this. It just, they're sitting there forever.
A lot of it is just talking them down and reassuring them and reminding them that really bloodborne pathogen transmission in the workplace is exceedingly rare. And so really, even the what are perceived as the highest risk exposures, the probability that you're going to get infected with them is still very low.
About 10 years ago, I used to use this web-based program called Needle Stick. What a great name. Where you'd punch in all the elements of the exposure and out would pop a post-exposure prophylaxis recommendation. It kind of reminded me of the big punch card computers where there'd be all this work going on and boop, this little thing would pop right out. And now MDCalc has something similar, but there's so much gray area in between the mouse clicks. Is there an algorithmic approach to make this easier, say a hierarchy of important information? What are the things that you want to know to help you decide high risk or low risk exposure?
For the Hep B and those parts of it, that is more algorithmic. That part of it is really more based on the vaccination status of the person who is exposed. Some of the HIV stuff is a little more nuanced. And what it basically boils down to is how much blood were they exposed to and how much HIV do you think is in that blood? Those are really basically the two essential factors that are going to go into our determination of whether we're going to recommend prophylaxis. The problem is that so often these are unknowns. You don't know what the source is, or you don't know the source's HIV status, or even if they are HIV positive, you don't know if they have a huge viral load or if they've got a non-detectable viral load. And sometimes it's kind of a judgment call even as to how much blood was exposed. Things like, was it a hollow needle stick? Was it a solid needle stick? Was there a lot of blood everywhere? Was there not a lot of blood everywhere? For the mucous membrane exposures, those are generally much lower risk. Still, people freak out about them. Very common ones are, patient spit and I got a little bit of saliva in my eye. And even though the healthcare worker is freaking out, the risk of transmission of a bloodborne pathogen in that exposure is pretty close to zero. It does take a little bit of a judgment call. And on some level, it's a risk aversion level decision. And so we do actually ask the person who is exposed to participate in that decision. Some people are willing to take that one in a million risk and not take antiretrovirals, not take HIV prophylaxis. Some people are going to want to take it and risk the toxicity and cost of the antiretrovirals, even just to prevent that one in a million.
Well, you mentioned unknown source, and say a housekeeper gets stuck with a needle that was in the trash. This happens in a disconcertingly regular frequency, and you don't know anything about the source patient. You just got a needle stick in the hospital. What do you do?
Really, it's the HIV is usually what's really freaking out the person who got exposed. They're going to worry that they've got HIV. With HIV, the risk that any random needle or something in the trash that a housekeeper gets stuck with, the probability that it's contaminated with HIV is relatively low. If you're just going to play the odds, there's something like 1.2 million people infected with HIV in the U.S. out of more than 300 million people. So right there, the risk is low. Now, of course, it's going to be higher than that in a hospital setting, but still, most patients in the hospital do not have HIV. So unless this happens in a specific HIV unit or something like that, then probably if you're going to just roll the dice and play the odds, it's going to be very low. HIV does not survive very long in dried blood or on needles. It probably lasts hours at the most at the outside. So a needle that's been sitting there for a while, even if there's blood on it, if it's all dried up, the probability that there's going to be HIV in it is very low. Remember that the risk, even the highest risk exposure that we're talking here, a hollow needle, fresh blood, absolute known HIV positive source, that's 1 in 300 to begin with. So we're talking 1 in 300 times 1 in 300 times the probability that the HIV in the needle is still viable. We're talking 1 in tens of thousands in most cases, and probably 1 in millions in most others. So it would be really unusual circumstances that would prompt us to recommend HIV post-exposure prophylaxis in this setting. It would have to be basically a setting in which there's a high probability that that blood is going to have HIV. It would have to be a relatively fresh needle with nice red, juicy, fresh blood dripping from it, and a deep stick from a hollow needle where there would have been some higher risk exposure. And that particular constellation of findings would be pretty uncommon.
With body fluid exposures, there's three main infectious pathogens that we worry about: hepatitis B, C, and HIV. With Hep B, the focus is not so much on what the person was exposed to, where they're exposed, etc. It's on the vaccination status of the exposed person, and something like, have they had post-vaccination antibody titers? But when we're talking about HIV, which is the crux of this conversation, body fluid exposure, how much fluid and how much HIV was in the fluid? The first part of that, well, we can pretty well know. You know, sometimes it can be a little bit murky, but we kind of know what they were exposed to, kind of how much there was. The second part, that's usually the black box. If it was a hospitalized patient, a rapid HIV test becomes a binary decision point, but more on that later. In the case we were just discussing, what about the random needle? It happens in the hospital. It happens in the community. How dangerous is that? It's certainly menacing to think about a blood-covered needle that just stuck my finger. What the heck? But HIV doesn't survive well outside the body, and the odds of getting HIV from this sort of exposure, it's really pretty low. The highest risk, at least from an occupational or needle exposure, is the hollow-bore needle injected HIV-positive blood. That's around a 1 in 300 chance of seroconversion. The worst case scenario with this random needle, you've got a 1 in 300 risk, and that's the one from the hollow bore needle with HIV positive blood, times 1 in 300, that's the incidence of HIV in the US population. Greg says 1 in 10,000, so it's actually more like 1 in 90,000. But considering the likelihood that the HIV survived in the first place, the amount of blood that gets injected, the risk is probably way lower.
Well, let's say somebody comes in and they have been stuck by a needle, but this is a patient in the hospital. A rapid HIV is drawn on the source patient and it's negative. Is it enough, a rapid HIV negative on the source patient, to say, okay, source patient's low risk, you don't have to worry?
Yes. Generally speaking, you are done. The rare circumstance that you might consider it would be if this is a patient who you think may be at risk of having acute retroviral infection, where they have HIV in their blood and yet their antibody has not yet become positive. That takes about 8 to 12 weeks for the antibody to become positive. That's an exceedingly rare scenario. And many places now, and including my own hospital, they have gone to the fourth generation test that also include a P24 antigen. So they can actually detect even those acute HIV infections before the antibody has become positive.
One thing that we have been seeing more and more of are cops who are bitten, and the people who bite them are often on some kind of a drug. They, you know, you don't really know about them, but kind of sketchy characters, and they've got some big teeth marks that drew blood. What do we do with that one?
You're certainly going to have one pissed off cop on your hands when that happens. Generally speaking, these are low risk exposures. You can't ever say that it's zero. There have been some really, really rare case reports of HIV transmission allegedly carried out through a human bite. Saliva doesn't really contain large amounts of HIV relative to other body fluids, blood, semen, those kinds of things. So it's not very effectively transmitted. It's not effectively transmitted through kissing, for example, through oral sex, those kinds of things. So it doesn't appear that saliva is a very effective means of HIV transmission. Maybe some, you know, meth guy who's got really horrible teeth and there's a lot of blood in the mouth and he bites. If there's a blood-to-blood component of the exposure, that would be one that you might consider to be a little higher risk. I wouldn't say you would never recommend HIV prophylaxis in that setting. It would be the rare circumstance that we would believe that the risk would be so high that we would be recommending HIV post-exposure prophylaxis for that kind of an exposure.
a negative rapid HIV on the source patient, that patient, for the purposes of deciding whether or not to administer post-exposure prophylaxis, is considered HIV negative unless the very unlikely scenario, but still possible, but unlikely scenario, that the source patient is in fact HIV positive, but has yet to develop the antibody. Some hospitals use the fourth generation test with the P24 antigen. That's going to identify HIV infection before seroconversion. Most people I've spoken with don't have that yet. Human bites, man, we see this a lot, especially in police officers. In general, low risk, as saliva does not contain large amounts of HIV compared to other body fluids. Still possible and definitely dramatic, but nowhere near as high risk as blood or semen. Now let's talk about the time sensitivity, because time is of the essence when it comes to treating a potential HIV exposure. What's the time interval from time of exposure in which you want to give the post-exposure prophylaxis meds and the time interval that makes a difference in terms of efficacy? Not talking days here, but does it matter hour to hour?
Probably so. The sooner the better is the recommendation. Within the time frame of an ER visit, it's not like there's a specific cutoff. It's not quite like our TPA measures for stroke and things like that. But you want to get it sooner rather than later. You know, the idea is that you want to get the antiretrovirals on board before the virus has jumped into the cells and before it can start to replicate. And that can happen over the time frame of hours. The data on these on this thing are poor. You know, there's no real studies of this. HIV workplace occupational transmission is such a rare event. Clearly, we're never going to have studies with hundreds or thousands or even dozens of cases for that matter. You can do sort of case control studies and look back and see what happened. You know, we do have reasonably good evidence that HIV post-exposure prophylaxis will reduce that risk based on kind of case control studies, just looking at people who got it and who didn't for high-risk exposures. We're not really going to be able to parse it out as to how much that risk increases minute by minute after the exposure. Just on a theoretical basis, it makes sense if you're going to give it sooner rather than later. And if you're not sure, it's reasonable to go ahead and give that first dose. The toxicity really happens more over time, and the toxicity of a single dose of antiretroviral drugs is relatively low. If you're not sure and everybody's freaked out and you want to just kind of do something while you're sorting it out and letting the dust settle, in some circumstances, I've done this too. You give the first dose. Give your first dose of, you know, Truvada, for example, is a commonly used one, with or without a third drug on top of it. Truvada is a combination of two drugs. So for a high-risk exposure, sometimes we'll give three drugs. If you want to kind of give something while you're sorting out what's going on, it's not unreasonable to go ahead and give that first dose. Many emergency departments will actually have it in their Pyxis or have it readily available in some way from the pharmacy for that very circumstance. And then you can kind of sit back, you can reassure the person exposed that, yes, you've got that first dose on board now. Let's sit back and we can more leisurely gather information, get that HIV result from the source patient, and then go from there. I don't do that in most cases because in the vast majority of them, the source patient is HIV negative. You don't even need to give that first dose. So, you know, in most circumstances, you do have the luxury of time to wait for that rapid HIV test to come back from the source. But if it's going to be a challenge to get it, if the patient is uncooperative, you don't have any available blood to test, those kinds of scenarios, and you think it's a high-risk exposure, yes, that would be a reasonable thing to do.
And what's your time cutoff when the medications, at least in theory, don't work for post-exposure prophylaxis?
The one that people commonly use is around 72 hours. If it's been more than that, it's felt that probably the benefit of post-exposure prophylaxis is not likely to outweigh the risk. You're probably not going to prevent the infection if it's already occurred at that point. And so the strategy at that point becomes, well, let's just follow them. Let's recognize that even for a high-risk exposure, even if this is one that we might have given prophylaxis if they'd come in immediately, still the risk of a hollow needle stick is 1 in 300. So there's a 299 out of 300 chance that you're not going to help them at all, giving them that prophylaxis.
72 hours is going to be the cutoff, but the goal is to administer the medication sooner rather than later. The sooner, the better. Now, we talked earlier about the needle stick from the trash, or sometimes it happens there's a child playing in the park, they reach into the garbage and ouch, needle stick. And many of these are going to be insulin syringes. Some of them are going to be syringes that have been used on people who do have HIV, hepatitis C, etc. And one question that I've been asked, and I suspect that you have been asked this too, is, Can't you just test the needle and see if there's any disease in it?
They just stare at you incredulously when you tell them, no, we really don't have any way to do that. There isn't really a mechanism to do that, especially if it's old and dried, maybe in that. And I've never encountered this circumstance. If you did have a, you know, nice fresh syringe full of liquid blood and there was a high risk exposure, theoretically, you might be able to, if you had some liquid blood to test, you could do it. I've never encountered that scenario. And generally it's, you know, it's some old, dirty, dried up, stomped upon needle. They can't believe that. What, in this day and age, we can, you know, send a man to the moon and you can't test a needle for HIV.
Let's change gears and address the high-risk exposure. The source is HIV positive. It's a hollow-bore needle stick. It drew blood. It went deep. You want them to take medications. They want to take medications. You give them the starter pack and the ED.
What are they going to take? How long are they going to need to take it? And what's their follow-up? And by follow-up, I mean, when does their first appointment need to happen? How often do they need to get tested? What's getting tested in these follow-up visits? And if everything's negative, when are they clear for no more checks?
I would recommend that if you're at that decision point, you're going to want to get your ID doc involved, and they can talk to you about dosing, all of that. The general approach is we're going to treat it for 4 weeks. That's the general post-exposure prophylaxis regimen. We'll get some baseline labs of liver function tests. We're going to get CBC. We'll get some of that stuff baseline. We'll do their baseline HIV test for the person exposed. They're going to typically get a follow-up repeat HIV antibody test at 8 to 12 weeks. They're going to get another one out to 6 months. Some people will recommend doing another one even outside of 6 months. 6 months is kind of generally regarded as the outside limit of when somebody's going to seroconvert if they were infected. Theoretically, some people think, well, if we're giving the post-exposure prophylaxis, you might delay that. So some people will recommend another test, you know, maybe just to be extra double sure at 12 months. But generally, it's going to be out to 6 months. We'll start that first drug. We'll send those baseline tests from the emergency department. We'll set them up for a follow-up within a week at our occupational health just to make sure they're tolerating those first few doses. We will typically dispense a little starter pack of like 3 to 4 days worth of medications from the emergency department. Then they can come into that first visit. They can see how they're tolerating it. Sometimes if you're waiting for follow-up testing from the source patient or from the person who is exposed, they may be adjusting things for either Hep B or for some other part of the exposure. But mostly that first visit is to just kind of make sure they're tolerating the medications okay, see if they might need to switch over to something else. And then typically they'll continue that for 4 weeks, and then they'll do that follow-up testing at, say, 2 to 3 months, and then at 6 months.
Does it make a difference with the follow-ups if the source patient is unknown versus if the source patient is HIV positive and then the patient goes down the road of starting post-exposure prophylaxis?
Generally speaking, no. Because if you've made a decision that you're going to start post-exposure prophylaxis, that's based on a perception that there is a high enough risk that this could realistically transmit HIV. I guess the one difference would be if the source is known HIV positive and you have access to testing, sometimes that information about resistance, antiviral drug resistance patterns, et cetera, you may not have access to that in the middle of the night at the time of the exposure, but you may have access to that in the light of day during the week when the source patient's ID doc is available or their clinic information is available. So in some circumstances, you might have access to that. And that would be something that the occupational health and ID docs might be tweaking their regimen a few days down the line if they have access to that information. But generally speaking, the follow-up is going to be pretty much the same.
Rapid HIV testing, I feel, has so much changed the game for the exposures that we have in the hospital, sometimes in the community if everybody comes in the hospital. But what if a source patient refuses HIV blood test or even a blood draw, or they're unable to consent? Is permission to draw a state-by-state issue? Are there general rules to follow on who we can or can't draw blood from? Or maybe there's a patient who's really intoxicated and they refuse?
In terms of the legal avenues that you have, that does vary state to state. Most states will have some kind of an avenue for testing in these circumstances for either healthcare workers, sometimes for, say, EMS workers, for cops, for those kinds of things, but it does vary state to state. Now, generally speaking, now in most states, it used to be that you routinely had to get a written consent to test for HIV. In most places, you don't have to do that anymore. So if you have blood available, generally speaking, you can test it in most places. You don't need an explicit written consent to test available blood. Now, if you have to get a patient to consent to getting a needle stuck into them, then that would be something that you would need to get their permission for. Even if you have some law in place that allows you to draw their blood against their will. In some states, it requires a court order, for example. In some places, as long as it fits certain circumstances, you can do it without a court order. But you just think about the logistics of this. I mean, imagine, you know, a bunch of nurses trying to actually forcibly hold somebody down against their will while they're screaming and fighting and kicking and spitting and try to jab a needle in them and draw blood. You're going to wind up with 5 needle sticks at the end of that scenario. So on a practical level, that's probably not going to work. And I think your best avenue is just try to explain to the source patient why it's important and why they need to do it. Now, if they're psychotic or drunk, then, you know, that's all going to be in vain, probably. And in some circumstances, you may need to go through the legal avenues if you're going to get a court order, et cetera. And in the meantime, you're going to have to make a decision based on the perceived risk, estimated risk, the information that's available, if you know whether or not that patient is HIV positive or not.
So maybe while you're getting all that settled down, maybe that's the patient you would want to give that first dose of post-exposure prophylaxis while you're waiting to get the blood from the source patient, if that's even possible.
If you think it's a high-risk source patient, then yeah, that would be an appropriate scenario to do that.
What do you advise people who are starting post-exposure prophylaxis? You think it's a high-risk exposure, intercourse with their partner after the exposure. Do you say, don't have intercourse for the next 6 months, or use a condom for X months, or have your partner take post-exposure prophylaxis?
I would basically advise them that the risk is exceedingly low, but you cannot guarantee them that the risk is zero. Probably for peace of mind, if nothing else, it might be prudent to use barrier precautions in the interim.
Okay, hierarchy of risk of transmission. We've talked about this somewhat, but just to hammer it down. So you've got fresh blood, dried blood, semen, urine, saliva, and vomit.
That's probably a pretty good hierarchy there. I think you called it in the order of risk. Once you get past fresh blood, then the risk of all of those other things goes down. A single instance of vaginal intercourse, you know, HIV positive male, HIV negative female, the likelihood of transmission in that scenario, estimated to be probably at least on the order of 1 in 1,000. Now, there are other factors that can go into that when we're talking about, you know, sexual assault, for example, if there's blood exposure, if there's trauma, if there's damage to mucous membranes, et cetera, there are some circumstances that could increase that risk. But generally speaking, it's very low.
Post-exposure prophylaxis treatment, you're not going to be the one managing this, but you'll almost certainly be the one getting asked the question. So the basics. Patient's going to get baseline labs, 4 weeks of antiretroviral treatment, follow-up visit in about a week to check on med tolerance, repeat HIV antibody at 8 to 12 weeks and in 6 months. Looking at different guidelines, there's different tests that are done. Sometimes that depends on the source patient and also different times that it is tested, but that's a rough estimate. As far as estimated risk of HIV transmission from blood exposure from a known HIV positive source, we haven't hit on all of these, but there are three numbers that I keep in my brain so that I can give them to the patient because they're kind of the three important numbers you want to know. Hollow bore needle stick, risk is around 1 in 300. Mucous membrane exposure, risk is around 1 in 1,000. Non-intact skin exposure, risk is greater than 1 in 1,000. 1 in 300, 1 in 1,000, greater than 1 in 1,000. I want to finish up with a question that comes up with regularity, and that is, should we give post-exposure HIV prophylaxis to victims of sexual assault? Not exactly needle sticks, but kind of along the same line. We just heard Greg talk about the risk of transmission from an HIV-positive man to an HIV-negative woman, estimated to be around 1 in 1,000.
In my practice, at least, I think the only things that would make me really consider strongly giving post-exposure HIV prophylaxis after a sexual assault would be some reason to believe that the assailant is more likely to be infected with a bloodborne pathogen, and also some kind of blood exposure. There's trauma, you know, and potential of blood exposure from the source patient, from the assailant in this example, maybe some blood or mucous membrane damage or some kind of exposure in the person who is exposed. But in general, the risk of that is so low that your risk-benefit analysis is going to come out not on the side of recommending prophylaxis. It's, you know, it's expensive, it's toxic, and just, you know, really not worth the benefit for such a low-risk exposure in most cases.
Summary.
So there you go, some post-exposure HIV prophylaxis basics, or at least some scenarios such as the random needle in the trash. Pretty low risk unless it's got fresh blood on it or there's another mitigating circumstance. Human bites, also low risk. A negative rapid HIV test for the sake of deciding on post-exposure prophylaxis can be interpreted as an HIV negative source patient unless there's a really, really high suspicion of infection so acute there's not yet been seroconversion. If you're going to start treatment, the goal is within 72 hours, but the sooner the better. You may have ID docs you can consult. We don't in our hospital, so I use a combination of MDCalc. It has the HIV needle stick risk assessment stratification protocol, the RASP, and I also use the UCSF clinicians post-exposure prophylaxis line. It is 1-888-448-4911. That number in the show notes.